Hi, I'm Courtney Rowan, and
which is me.
Hi, I'm Dave Faulkner, and this is the EdTech Podcast.
Hi, I'm Courtney Rowan, and welcome to the EdTech Podcast.
Hello, I'm Stefan Kasper, and this is the EdTech Podcast.
Hi, I'm Kelly Long, and this is the EdTech Podcast.
Hello, I'm Lauri Järvilehto, and you're listening to the EdTech Podcast.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the EdTech Podcast. This week I've been speaking at the University of Southampton mini podcasting conference on the topic of podcasting for academics. Podcasting is an amazing medium for sharing and testing ideas, connecting and making visible your own research. Check out hashtag SOTONPod16 to catch up with slides or connect with other academics who were involved, including Martin Auswick of Answer Me This or UCL fame. A big shout out also to Stephen Kasper at the University of Southampton at the Institute for Learning, Innovation and Development for putting on such an amazing event. It was great also to catch up with Fiona Harvey, Vice Chair of the Association of Learning Technology, and her iChamps, students assisting academics with digital literacy and innovative delivery in teaching. All that coming up on a future episode of the EdTech Podcast. In other news this week, ELT Jam have been announced as the launch party drink sponsor, with Clearly So and Firefly Learning as welcome sponsors. Massive welcome to those guys, and do go and check them all out on Twitter. This week, I'll be announcing the lineup for the EdTech Podcast live panel, and you can tweet your thoughts and follow at hashtag EdTechPod. There are a few final sponsor opportunities for the launch party if you're interested, and some further exciting announcements about podcast sponsors also coming up. And so on to this week's podcast. On the week that former Mighty Eagle Angry Bird and founder of Mobile Monday and Slush announced his full move in the Business Insider from Rovio to Lightning, it's one I'm super excited about. I'm in an interview with Lauri Järvilehto, who is the CEO of Lightning, a new edtech startup focusing on learning games, which have the ambition to be as great as any mobile game out there.
The game that we're going to launch is going to be a kind of a, like Pokemon for particle physics.
Lauri is from Finland, and I get a bit This Is Your Life with him, going right back to the beginning with his parents and siblings, uncovering how successfulness is a family affair with his brothers, father and mother across gaming, entertainment and academia. The podcast covers the unique landscape in Finland where ex-Nokia engineers meet government-funded advanced media graduates, all from an inclusive system of education, which Järvilehto calls a work of art.
You know, what do you get when you get, you know, when you put amazing engineers and amazing media people in the same table? Well, you get games, right?
Järvilehto is a dream interviewee, incredibly humble, wide-eyed and affable in the extreme. I hope that transmits as we sit in the Le Mercury Hotel in central Piccadilly, including the moment where a newborn tests his or her lungs out for the very first time. For me, there is nothing more pleasurable than to hear the phrase mind-boggling stuff in a Finnish accent.
With all these equations and all this like mind-boggling stuff.
I also loved the takeaway of embracing the idea of Wittgenstein's ladder, i.e. don't be greedy about retaining knowledge as cultural capital to be regurgitated as quotes or refrains, more use it in your experiences and approaches to get on in life or business, adding to a wider wisdom in the process. Don't forget to subscribe, share and review, and enjoy! Welcome to this week's The EdTech Podcast. I'm fantastically excited to have Lauri Järvilehto from Lightning here with me today, and we're in Piccadilly in London. Lauri is someone I came across through a podcast recording with the EdTech investor Deborah Quazzo, and has a fantastically interesting background, both in academia and education in that sense, right up to edtech and sort of gamification and the whole spectrum there. So really, really keen to get involved with this podcast, and so much so that I almost came a week early to this meeting. So luckily I didn't, because Lauri was in the United States of America, so that would have been quite awkward. So just to kick off, for those of you who won't have the background, from what I understand, I'm just going to do a quick overview of a whistle-stop tour of, you'll say, past 10 or 12 years. You are able to speak English, Finnish, French, German, Swedish, Latin and Polish?
To some extent, yeah.
Okay. You started off playing piano in a swanky restaurant. You then worked for a year as a web designer at the Department of Music Education and Department of Behavioural Sciences at a university. You then conducted and composed music for the Swedish Theatre of Finland for a year. You then ran a music production studio for 12 years, including penning a song which had over 5 million copies. Yeah. Lots of nodding heads here. This is good. You then taught a course on analytic philosophy for 4 years.
No, I actually taught the course only for half a year.
Okay, half
so
a
that's
year. Half
the four-year span was my PhD studies.
You then applied that philosophical insight to the world of executive training, creating a productivity app, and most recently, up to last year, you were working at Angry Birds developer Rovio, working in researching and developing a framework for education games.
Yeah,
that's quite a lot to achieve in such a short amount of time. And in terms of Angry Birds, that you worked on Angry Birds Space, which was a solar system, a learning game developed together with NASA, mm-hmm. based on Angry Birds. And this brings us up to the present day, into Lightning, which I'm very excited to find out more about, and how I came about this, you know, was understanding this is going to be a game about the various elements of the periodic table, going on adventures, and through those adventures, helping to teach children about physics and science and so on. So, to go back to the beginning, I'm going to ask some very, you know, questions about you. So, how old are you? Where are you from? Where did you grow up? And how is your life different to that of your parents, for example?
Oh, wow. So, I'm 39 years old, and I was born and live in Helsinki, Finland, but I actually grew up all the way up north in Oulu, in a city that basically gets practically no sunlight in the winter and gets nothing but sunlight in the summer. So that's a kind of a place where I spent my childhood and teenage years. How my life is different from my parents. Now that's something to think about. I think actually, you know, it's pretty interesting because in a sense, I've never realized this until now, but it just struck me that I've also never been asked a question like that before. So I think in a sense I've sort of I've lived a portion of my life sort of in the footsteps of my mother and another portion in the footsteps of my father. And I'm actually like sort of like in this like phase where I'm combining a lot of the stuff I've learned down the road in something that I find like, you know, that's no longer sort of connected to my heritage. Although, like, you know, I must add that both my older brothers are in gaming business and they're pretty, like, you know, experienced. And so maybe I'm kind of like now in the same business with my brothers. So it's kind of like, you know, maybe one day I'll do something completely of my own.
Who knows?
But I mean, what I'm saying is just my mom, she used to be in the entertainment business. She used to be actually a TV hostess. Then she was a documentary director. She's done like lots of TV work, stuff like that. So I felt like when I was doing music for a living that I was actually also like, you know, I was working with like mom's friends and like, you know, in the same sort of social circle. And then when I moved to science, my dad's an emeritus professor of neuroscience and psychology. So then I kind of like, you know, when I did my PhD, so I was like spending a lot of time like brainstorming with my dad and like, you know, trying to figure out how the world works and how the mind works. And so I guess now I'm sort of like in a position where I get to sort of combine both the lessons learned in the entertainment business and also the lessons learned in science into really creating something that I hope will have a huge impact on the way we learn.
Fantastic. And do you still kind of call back to them for advice and that kind of thing? Or is it more your own network of people that are in, you know, your business now?
Definitely, yeah. And I think, like I mentioned, my brothers are both pretty well established in the Finnish gaming scene. So they're like, you know, they're really amazing. They're like, I could just call them in the middle of the night, like, help me with this. And like, how does this work? And it's pretty amazing. So,
which companies do they work for?
They're twins, so okay, they're 5 years older than me. The older one, so the one who's 30 minutes older, so he runs a company called Seriously, and they've done pretty well. I think they have about 30 or 40 million downloads. So he's actually been involved in most of the big successes. So he was one of the founding members of Remedy Entertainment. He ran Rovio's gaming unit for quite some time. So he's been involved in quite a bit of the Finnish gaming superstars. And my other brother, Aki, so he runs a company called Everywhere Games. That's the number one maker of games for the Apple Watch. So they're the world leader in wearable games. So if I have a little minority complex every now and then, just blame my brothers.
It's always good to do. Yeah, I have a brother. It's always very useful. And do you think there's a sort of uneven weighting towards the success of gaming and now sort of edtech gamification from Finland? Do you think there's a greater proportion of people there? And if so, what's that about? Is that to do with the Nokia effect and so on?
I think Finland is just it's a uniquely positioned place to create learning games. We have obviously a disproportionate amount of successes in gaming, Supercell, Rovio, Remedy, Red Lynx. For a country of 5 million people, it's just crazy to and they just keep popping up. So there was just very recently a new studio, Traplight Games, just launched a game that went to 1 million downloads in a week. And that's it's a tough market. It's it's crazy hard to get 1 million downloads, period. And these guys, a new studio from Tampere, Finland, they just cracked it in a week. So it's it just keeps happening. I guess you're right about it, that Nokia has been a sort of an incubator for this. I have this crazy theory. I don't know if it's true. It's more touchy-feely than anything substantial, but I might as well share it. So, I think the reason why Finland is so huge in games specifically is that on one hand, when Nokia scaled down, we got an abundance of amazing engineering talent. And on the other hand, for some strange reason, Finnish education policy was sort of constructed around the idea of sort of demand. So basically those topics that were in most demand got most funding. Okay. And it turns out, with generation whatever it's, Y, X, Y, Z that's going on right now, media and making films and animations and music and whatnot, it's pretty popular for this generation.
So actually sort of governmental investment in the skills areas that were required had a real effect.
We basically trained a huge amount of these initially unemployed what are called, I don't know what is it in English, but medianomi. So it's a kind of a bachelor level degree in media. And these guys were just amazing skilled people that just didn't have anything, to apply their skills to, because there are so many jobs in TV, right? And then these animation and filmmaking people, all of a sudden bumped into these people who would be laid off from Nokia. And what do you get when you get when you put amazing engineers and amazing media people in the same table? Well, you get games, right? So that's my kind of little pet theory about what's going on.
I like that theory. Everyone listening, you should say what you think about that theory. I think it'd be good to get a debate going on it.
So the other thing, the gaming thing is pretty amazing, but the other amazing thing is we're also really great in education. So Finland is basically you take whatever chart that's measuring the top 10 in the world, and Finland is almost always in top 3, top 5 at least, and often number 1. And that's just crazy. And the cool thing is that Finnish education is unique in the sense that it's so inclusive. So it's no matter what your heritage is, no matter what your parents do for a living, you get to go to a great school with great teachers. And this is a kind of this is why what's so super exciting working with these amazing people in Lightnear is that we have this we have this very close proximity to super good education and to amazing game talent. And now we're sort of trying to figure out the formula of how to make the two sort of not just coexist, but actually synergize with one another.
Definitely. Let's come back to Lightnear, because I want to do a proper in-depth jump into that. But just to go back to some of your earlier influences, for example, do you have any interesting stories from your Swedish Theatre of Finland trips, Extended Mind, the Academy of Philosophy? What kind of memories do you bring back from those earlier days?
Let me think. So So I was really young when I decided that I want to be a musician or a music producer. I was 14 when I sort of like just came up with this crazy idea. And I was living in this very small, well, fairly small northern Finnish town. And everybody was telling me, like, you know, you're crazy. You can't make any money from music. And just get a proper job. But I really, like, sort of, I didn't have anything else to do. I didn't like to go to school that much or anything. So I just did a lot of music. And I already wrote my first TV series music, I think I was 17 or so. And then around after high school, I moved to Helsinki and I got my first big like TV gig around 19 years. So I was writing like music for this entire TV show, like just sort of doing this John Williams style thing, like, you know, finding themes for the main characters. And then like every single song was like tailor-made through the show. So there wasn't like, you know, repeated music, but I kind of like was like through composed. I don't know how do you say it in English, but that's the kind of a literal translation from Finnish. So that was pretty cool. The Swedish theater thing was also like, it was one of their biggest productions ever, The Lord of the Rings. And I was working with this legendary Finnish composer and like you like conducting this very small band with like, you know, basically he made the kind of like the vocal songs. And then kind of gradually I got the chance to actually do, like, you know, music for the actual dance numbers. So I started out as the conductor and ended up being a kind of a co-composer. So I was, like, working with this legendary figure. So it was pretty amazing. I kind of, like, I really loved doing the theater production. But I kind of, like, doing, we did 100 shows altogether. So that kind of, like, I grew a little wary about that in the end. But it was still amazing, like, working with those guys.
And it was a lot of travel and...
No, it was all in the center of Helsinki. Okay, it's one of the, like, it's actually in the very, like, very, very center of Helsinki, the theater. So it's like...
Got you. So, 100 shows in the same place, that's quite intense.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was pretty heavy through 1 year.
And so looking at your CV here, so what's clear to me is this real interest or passion for philosophy. How important is that to you? And, you know, which are the philosophers that you think are relevant in the sort of modern day and that kind of thing?
Well, philosophy is something that's been with me since I was a very small kid. So I already mentioned that my dad, I mean, he was a professor of psychology, and I used to be a test subject when I was at, like, you know, 7 years old. So I'd have these electrodes coming out from my head and I'd play a computer game and he'd measure what happens in my brain. And but then we'd also have these, like, amazing, like, when I was, like, 5 years old or something, we'd have these, like, you know, why does the world exist and why does it rather exist than not exist, and all this, like, you know, sort of, like, highbrow kind of thinking. And it stuck with me. So I really love especially this sort of classical idea of philosophy, this, like, love of wisdom, love of understanding, thinking about big questions about, like, I did my PhD in epistemology, the theory of knowledge. So my kind of task was to figure out how is knowledge actually structured, actually a very specific area of knowledge like mathematics and logic, and that led me to another topic, intuitive thinking. So how do we kind of how do ideas pop in our heads and stuff like that? And that actually led me to learning, which led me to, like, you know, out of all the things in the world, like working with Rovio. And basically, because my sort of postdoctorate study was about how these different structures of thinking work and how they're formed, which is basically, you know, what learning is, how thinking is formed. And so I think it's still, like, you know, I haven't done active research in a year and a half, 2 years or so. So I kind of the sort of when I started like working with Rovi around late 2011 as a consultant, and I actually wrote a book for them called Learning is Fun. That's still, I think it should be available as an ebook on Amazon. And then I kind of gradually started sort of like getting more and more involved in that. And so I was actually never employed by Rovio. So that I was always like under a consulting agreement and doing these 2 or 3 month stints. But the last year or so of the, like, before Rovio decided to shut down their learning unit, I was pretty much like full time, like working with the team there, which was some of the most amazing time in my life. So I mean, these people are just, they were and are just amazingly brilliant. And I think we laid the whole groundwork pretty much, like, you know, at least in terms of the philosophy of this fun learning in those years. So now it's more like, I think, I mean, like I said, I don't do active research, so I don't want to. I'm kind of like wary of, like, because I'm still asked, like the Finnish media asked me to comment on this and that as a kind of a like research authority, but I'm kind of like a little like distanced from that. So I've been really hands-on now with like this game design business for the last couple of years. But the philosophy, the idea of still wanting to sort of like embrace big thoughts, big ideas, is strong with me, but I want to combine it with impact. Yeah. I want to make those big thoughts make a difference.
That was going to be my next question. You know, how do you, yes, there will be edtech startups listening, there will be, you know, teachers going back to school, senior leadership teams going back to school, and I suppose how do you marry philosophical ideas with the day-to-day where you're kind of, you know, always on your feet trying to just get from one day to the next and, yeah, like you say, create the impact. So how do you keep those things together?
Well, that's something, I mean, in my previous company, the Academy of Philosophy, that's something that we got to sort of already practice. That company's idea was to go to businesses and ask them, like, you know, what kinds of troubles do you have? How could we help you somehow? And then go back to the books and back to the theories and figure out whether there's something you could sort of like bridge into those challenges.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of bridge building is something that I've been super excited about for a long, long time, because I think there is a kind of a rift between academia and, you know, the rest of the world. And many academic, like, people, highly educated people, they feel like, you know, that sort of like you have to have such like high level conceptual clarity to have acceptable thinking that sort of distances itself from real life problems. So finding the kind of way to take that sort of really, really, really super specific knowledge and then translate it into a language that makes sense for somebody who doesn't want to read
the whole of Kant.
35. Yeah. So that's always been pretty exciting to me. And in a sense, I think that's also kind of an idea that we're building now with Lightnear, because the whole cornerstone of Lightnear is to create amazing games that are as games as great as the best games in the world. So that's the kind of like the starting idea was that could we create a learning game that stands on its own, so that if you give somebody the chance to play our game or something like Candy Crush Saga, mm-hmm, about 50% of the people will choose our game because they love it as much as Candy Crush Saga. And that idea is also like basically like introducing, right now we're working with, out of all the things in the world, particle physics with experts from CERN and, like, you know, professors from Harvard and Oxford, like, you know, backing us up. And still the game needs to be as much fun as Angry Birds.
Yep.
So it's still kind of a bridge from this, like, yay, I'm having fun. I'm, like, you know, just shooting atoms and creating, like, collecting protons and or quarks and creating protons and making all these, like, you know, furry little creatures. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, when you go to school, you know, you encounter the periodic table the first time, you go like, hey, I know this is that cool stuff that I had in the game. And that's, like, you know,
yeah,
so much fun.
It's not an intimidating thing anymore.
Exactly.
So, okay, well, let's jump into, so some of the people you, well, first of all, okay, let's go right back to the beginning. So why don't you explain to everyone what Lightnear is, when it started, when it's launching?
Okay, Rovio started looking into learning games in late 2011. And then we worked on it, like, I worked on and off with them. They eventually, like, started the whole unit that was helmed by this amazing lady, Sanna Lukander, who was originally the head of books publishing at Rovio, and then she pretty much, like, you know, single-handedly started this unit that at the end of that, at its heyday, had about 37 people working on learning, all kinds of learning, not just learning games, but all kinds of learning projects.
And why did that close in the end? What was the kind of reasoning behind that?
I think, you know, well, it's been like, there's been a lot of, like, media coverage on the sort of turbulence that Rovio faced. And I think we spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to fit learning in the new strategy of Rovio. And I think from Rovio's point of view, and as you can see, obviously, like, right now, I think they did, even though it was painful and was, I think, sad for sort of the future of learning mission that we share, I think it was a right call to focus on entertainment, mm-hmm, because they've really got their, like, game back together, so to speak, and they got the movie out and it was a huge success. They've been making amazing new games, so I think that was the right call in the larger scale
for
of things
to focus on.
Yeah,
area.
And that's that. I mean, they basically just really refocused the whole strategy, and, you know, now you can see the results. So I think that's That was a smart move.
And then the story behind that is that you then, with your partners, kind of thought, okay, well, let's crack this together. And so was that an exciting time in terms of, you know, deciding that's what you were going to do? And
that was just, it was a strange time. So I left Rovio at the end of April 2015. And so Rovio had done these, like, you know, these partnerships. So actually, like, our marketing director Tina and CMO Maria had, like, you know, worked with NASA and CERN and these pretty amazing partners, and they'd started these sort of, like, you know, amazing partnerships. And especially we even visited CERN a couple of times and went to see the particle accelerators and spent time with these amazing, like, top of the world physicists who are, like, madly, like, childlike in love with physics. And it's like you can see the excitement and the enthusiasm these guys have, you know, for physics. And it's just it's so amazing working with them. So when we understood that this, like, you know, that is not gonna happen inside Rovio anymore. So I left at the end of April. A couple months before me, Lauri Konttori, who was the guy who started Rovio's animation studio, who'd kind of created the Angry Birds universe. So he'd left a couple months earlier. And actually the very first workshop that I participated in 2011 at Rovio was with Sanna, Lauri, and then this guy Jan Schulte-Tigge. So of the four of us, just like the whole thing pretty much, like, you know, when I started getting involved, was just a workshop with the four of us. And when Lauri left, we kind of just got together and we had this idea, like, you know, that it's a shame that we never got to do the physics game. And then the learning unit actually did ship the Angry Birds solar system that I'd been, like, helping get started at Rovio.
Yeah.
And so they, at the end of the day, just right before closing down, they shipped Rovio's first and for the time being last learning game, which was pretty amazing. And we, like, synchronized the launch with the flyby of Pluto with NASA, and there was, like, you know, it's just so crazy
interplanetary
marketing. And and we had this campaign, like, you know, the people had to, like, tap on this Pluto icon on the game if they want to, you know, return Pluto back to planethood. And so it was just, like, you know,
you've got that look that you just described about those scientists just a minute ago.
yeah. No, but I think that's the thing, like, yeah. I love so much working with these people who are, like, you know, because you think about, like, you know, world-class scientists, and, like, the stereotype would be somebody who's really highbrow and boring,
starchy.
But these guys, they're just, like, you know, they're so into it, and they're, like, you know, their eyes slide up when they talk about protons and neutrons and atoms and whatever, like, you know, it's just amazing.
So, I mean, this is what I was going to say. So some of the people now on your board or advisors are Peter, is it Vesterbacher?
Yeah.
Founder of Slush and co-founder of Mobile Mondays. Yeah. Used to work in telecom, so I remember that. Brent Hoberman, lastminute.com, may.com and Founders Forum. Pasi Salberg, so professor of education at Harvard University. And Rolf Landua, head of global engagement at CERN. So, I mean, that's a pretty solid and amazing list. So this is one of my questions, but you've kind of already talked about it. It's like, what's it like working with those people and, you know, bring them all together and sort of moving everything forward with such an amazing group of people?
It's beyond anything I've ever dreamed about before, quite honestly. You know, the sort of shared love for what we're building, the shared sort of sense of mission is so tangible. And, like, you know, we have an amazing office in Helsinki. Our core team, like our engineers, our art people, our designer, like, you know, they're, like, you know, it's just like every morning you come to work and you kind of feel blessed being able to work with these people. And then our advisors being, like, everybody being sort of, like, top of their own field.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's been strange, quite honestly, like, you know, to get into this position where you can actually bring so many amazing people together and they just click. The feeling that is, you know, let me tell you a little what happened back in the day. So when we started Lightnear, I brought the very core team, so basically our lead designer and Lauri and me, and I think it was the three of us. Yeah, a couple of other people. We went to CERN to spend one day with, like, workshopping with the top physicists of CERN. So Rolf was leading the workshop, and then they had a couple of, like, you know, one lady who was, like, you know, doing research with the Large Hadron Collider, and then this guy who'd, like, you know, built all their exhibitions and was doing research in some other, like, detector. And so the idea is that we're going to spend 8 hours brainstorming ideas of how to build a game with Sir. This happened a little less than a year ago. And so we come to Geneva in the morning plane. We're all a little dazed and confused. And we come to the facilities. And then we go to this conference room. And we, like, you know, meet up and have some coffee. And then, like, you know, the guy's far away. And they launched this presentation. And on the first slide, they had maybe 37, like huge equations. So, guys, here's how particle physics works. And I could see, like, you know, the blood leaving the face of our team, and we'd all go, like,
ask you any questions.
It's like, you know, oh gosh, so this is, like, we're going to spend 8 hours looking at these equations that, you know, we don't even understand the symbols, let alone, like, you know, what they stand for. And it's like, you know, I could see the whole feeling, like, you know, the team was, like, you know, kind of like, oh gosh, this is going to be a long, long day. But what happened next was that I don't remember this guy's name, but he was like the guy who's for example built that big exhibition at CERN, and he starts explaining what's going on in this equation and how they, like, you know, describe these, like, particles, and they describe this they switched a few slides, and they describe this nuclear fusion chain where atoms, like, collide and create new atoms. And they started describing this sort of, like, you know, this situation. Rolf had actually early on described this very same thing, but then they're like, you know, it's like a sort of a kid in a candy store explaining about, like, the coolest thing they know, when you have, like, basically two helium atoms and you really slam them together. And that, you know, they showed this graph with all these equations and all this, like, mind-boggling stuff. And then basically when two helium atoms slam together, it creates a beryllium atom. But the problem is that the beryllium atom is unstable. So unless you introduce another, I think, proton straight away, it's just going to blow up. And me and Ilari, the lead designer, we just look each other in the eyes and we go, like, whoa, they're talking about how to design the game. And we're like, you know, all of a sudden, like, you know, the whole mood flips. And the whole team goes, like, hey, these guys are talking about game design, even though they're talking about particle physics.
Because if you don't get that traction straight away, things will explode, or...
Yeah. And, you know, exploding stuff, making stuff explode is, you know, it's a cool thing in games. So, and then all of a sudden, you know, the whole thing flipped. And then I've been thinking, because we'd been thinking a lot of how to create this sort of, like, interaction between these very, very high-level experts and game designers who might have practically any experience of the topic of the game, of the teaching, the learning topic of the game. And it turns out that the glue or the connection is the love for the topic itself. So these guys, the guys in our team, they're madly in love with designing amazing games. They work day in, day out to make amazing games. And these guys at CERN, they're madly in love figuring out how these little particles work. And that sort of shared love, at the end of the day, a day that we'd thought that it's going to be super long and hard and tedious, and our heads are going to hurt. And at the end of the day, we were like, you know, we just went to have dinner with Rolf, and we just, like, you know, we're all like, you know, just blah, 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 this is so amazing, and we can do this, and then let's do that. And Ilari was doing, like, designs in his like, booklet, and Lauri was drawing the first drafts of the characters, and it's just, like, it's just so, you know, this switch, and it's still, you know, the difficult equations, they're still there. But with the expertise of these amazing scientists, we were able to sort of, like, to figure out what are the sort of touching points there that you can share with pretty much anybody. And now we're in the situation where the game that we're going to launch is going to be a kind of like Pokemon for particle physics. So we're going to have the entire predict table at the end of the day. I mean, we're going to launch with the first 10 atoms. But at the end of the day, sometime by the end of next year, we're going to have the entire predict table modeled in these, like, Pokemon-like characters that Lauri and the other artists are designing. And then basically all of this, like, you know, the causal chain from, like, there was this thing called, the game is going to be called Big Bang Legends. So there was this thing called Big Bang, and that caused, you know, the existence of these little particles, quarks. And then when you have a bunch of these quarks, 3 to be exact, which is, you know, what happens in the game, you start figuring this out, you get a proton, and then you have other kinds of quarks, and you get the neutron, and then when you slam protons and neutrons together, you get atoms, and when you get atoms slammed together, you get bigger atoms. And then at the end of the day, you know, when you put these atoms, like, you know, when you put helium atoms in a balloon, it floats. And when you put boron atoms in a hockey stick, it's much stronger. And when you put neon atoms in Las Vegas, it lights up and da-da-da. And this whole causal chain from the Big Bang to the neon sign, from the Big Bang to the helium ball, with all the, like, you know, the important steps, is being modeled in the game that you don't even realize when you're playing that you're actually learning all this stuff. But then, like, you know, I've been doing, like, you know, I guess I'm my dad's son in this sense. So, like, every self-respecting mad scientist, I also experiment with my children. So I've been, like, giving prototypes of the game for my kids. And I can see, I mean, they're like constantly, like, you know, figuring out these, like, you know, hierarchies of particle physics. And they're like, you know,
how old are your kids?
Well, I have five kids, so the 4 and 7 year olds are the ones who play the game most. The 2 year old just got started, so I just took a photo of him playing. He played about 10 minutes of the game. He's like super. Now he's all the time like asking me, "Can I play the Atom game again?" And so I just snapped the photo of him, like, you know. So this is what it looks like when a 2 year old learns quantum physics. So it's, you know, it's not
like
exactly
steam coming out of his ears.
No, not steam. I mean, he's like super, like, you know, because it's a fun game to play. It's exciting. Yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, he loves just, he doesn't play it to learn physics. He plays it to have fun. And I need to add, I mean, I don't think my 2 year old actually, like, you know, still, I don't think he grasped the physics. I mean, that would be kind of like, you know, that would be already like too strange. But what is amazing that my 4 year old, I mean, he's already been able to grasp some of the elementary hierarchies of how quarks, protons, and atoms work with, like, you know, in this, like, large scale of things. And that's pretty crazy.
That must make your dad very happy.
Yeah, yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Amazing. And in terms of, let's drill down into, when's that going to be available for everyone listening?
It's going to be available in the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store. And we're going to soft launch at the end of November Finland, Singapore, Philippines, and Hong Kong. And then we're actually not in the games business. The typical sort of like way to launch a game is that you soft launch it, you test it with, like, some limited markets, so that if it turns out that the game doesn't work, for example, that people just, like, you know, don't like it that much, you still can even, like, pull it away and like sort of redevelop the game if you need to. So we're going to have at least a 2-month soft launch period. And then typically in gaming business, after the soft launch, when the game performs well, you can see that people love it, they're having fun with it. You do a hard launch, you basically push it just all over the world. And we're planning on not actually doing a hard launch at all. But, well, because one of the things about the game is that the game, we feel the game needs to be accessible to even small kids. And to be accessible, it means that we're, for example, employing a lot of voice acting. So we have an amazing sound designer, Jonas Turner, who's basically creating these, like, really, really amazing personas for the Atoms. And they're like, Berlium and Helium. And, like, you know, they're making these noises all the time. So you actually associate the character and the name automatically, because you get encounters with these voice actors a lot. But the problem is that, you know, for example, let's say Nitrogen, you know, it's Nitrogen in English. It's probably some, like, Latin derived word in most languages. But for example, in Finnish, it's Typpi. So it's kind of like, you know, that if you actually my kids call them, like, that's Nitrogen. So they pronounce that, because we don't have the voice acting plug. We have just the written names there now. So they call Typpi Nitrogen and Vety Hydrogen.
Oh, they're also almost sort of learning the language indirectly as well.
Yeah,
as a result.
Yeah.
And but the problem is you have to translate it
exactly.
When you go to a new market.
And we have to translate it. And so this is actually my co-founder, Lauri. He feels that this needs to be the most localized game ever. And it's a hugely ambitious. It's a tall order. So what we're planning to do is that we'll actually launch the game country by country. So we'll actually start here, right here in UK. So we are going to be at the BETS event. We're going to launch the game at the end of January here. Then we're going to, like, myself and Peter, we're going to basically go to a next country, something like, you know, for example, we haven't made the roadmap yet, but let's say Poland. And we're going to go to Poland, and we're going to launch the game there, and we're going to have the Polish translation ready. So then the Adams are going to talk Polish, and we're going to visit Polish schools, and we're going to talk with kids about how they feel about, you know, learning particle physics, and then rinse and repeat. So basically, Peter and myself, we're going to be on the road for at least 2 or 3 months, like starting January next year. And I'm super excited about it because this is very, you know, typically gaming companies don't send their, like, you know, sort of like, you know, CEO and number one figurehead just on the road for months because they feel like, you know, that there's other stuff. But we feel like that we want to go way to the kind of grassroots level. We want to meet those, you know, people who might become our fans and, like, you know, who we can, like, you know, show how the game works and talk with, and also get ideas, like, you know, how some, let's say, like, 8-year-old second grader in, like, you know, small countryside town in Poland thinks about things like particle physics. So I'm really excited about, like, you know, really hitting the road and, like, you know, going out with you know, and especially because I really love working with Peter because he's, like, you know, he's a force of nature. He's a phenomenal human being.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just going down there, meeting those people, talking, and also, like I said, it's a lot about, you know, the shared love for, like, creating these amazing games, for this, like, amazing product, the amazing team that we have. So I think it's the easiest way to sort of, like, you know, to show people that this is the level of inclusivity we want to be able to bring to the world, that everybody at the end of the day would have access to this high quality learning, no matter where they live, no matter what their heritage is. So that's one of the reasons why we're actually, like, putting the game in the App Store as a game, not in the education or kids category, because also for one thing, it needs to be able to stand on its own against the best games. So we don't want for us to get the kind of a free ride ticket because we're educational or learning. Mm-hmm. We want the game to be amazing as a game, period. The other reason is that we don't want to sell it or market it to schools or to young kids or something. The effect that we're looking for is basically, like, if young kids mm-hmm. get the choice, they rather play the games that their older siblings play. Every single, when we run these tests, every single kid, if they can choose a learning game or Candy Crush Saga, 10 out of 10 choose Candy Crush Saga. So even little kids, if they can choose themselves, they play not kids' games, but other games.
And on that note, I mean, do you see other games developers switching towards more educational learning games in that way? I mean, I'm just thinking about the success. Well, you were talking about soft launch and hard launch, and I was just thinking about Pokemon Go and that kind of thing. So what's your thoughts on others in the games industry and how they're going to tackle educational learning games as well?
I think I'm pretty sure that learning games are going to be a breakout category. So it's just a question of who's going to make the quote-unquote Angry Birds of learning.
Yeah.
I mean, before Angry Birds, mobile games were a niche, just like learning games are right now. They were, like, you know, some super advanced kind of gaming geeks were into mobile gaming, but they weren't a big market, they weren't a big thing. This pretty much one single game single-handedly turned it all over. And now I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think mobile games are bigger than other games. Or anyway, they're in the same ballpark. And it happened, like, it's 7 years ago that Angry Birds was published. And for quite some time now, seeing what happens in the learning game industry, I've been pretty excited about a couple of them. For example, there's an amazing studio in Norway called We Want to Know that has created a really, like, mind-blowing game called Dragon Box that teaches algebra to even very young kids. So there's lots of amazing games coming out there. And when one of those games can actually stand, like, that's why we started Lightning, when one of these games can stand on its own in the whole gaming market, demonstrate that you can make a learning game that's as much fun to play as any other game, that, I think, is going to be a pivotal moment, just like Angry Birds was for mobile games. And the reason I believe that this is going to, I mean, it's going to happen no matter what we do. And I think, you know, we have an amazing shot at trying to be, you know, be that company who's make this difference. But it's going to happen anyway. And the reason is relatively simple. It's that basically right now people spend about, on average, 2 hours a day playing mobile games. And that 2 hours, I mean, it's fun. It's like, you know, it helps with stuff like stress, but it's still kind of like 2 hours you just kind of, that sort of blows away. Now, imagine you could take a chunk of those 2 hours, just, you know, a small chunk to begin with, maybe a little more later on, and you're still having as much fun, and you're still, like, you know, alleviating stress and, like, you know, spending some time at the bus stop. But in addition, you're learning things. You're not just particle physics, but the vision is that in the end of the day, it's whatever. Like, you know, there's going to be, right now, there are thousands of amazing mobile game studios making amazing games. So 10 years from now, there's going to be thousands of amazing learning game studios making amazing learning games. And people are playing them like they now play casual games, but they're constantly learning more and more about, you know, a gamut of ideas. And this is kind of like thing where also, like, you know, in addition to this sort of like the pragmatics of it all, which is why I'm super confident that as soon as we crack the formula, this is going to happen. The other thing is that the sort of, like, you know, the whole market logic of how learning games can actually function in creating this like global paradigm shift in learning is just so crazy that as soon as somebody demonstrates this, the investors get a whiff of, okay, so this is happening. The growth opportunities just in terms of like economics are just unlike anything we've ever seen before. It's basically because, I mean, still mobile games are as a whole about $30 or $40 million market. Education is about, you know, it's the second biggest market in the world. It's like, you know, the estimations are in trillions. And like bridging from this one market to the other, showing that you can actually play a game, have fun, and that can spark this sort of like even a lifelong love for something like particle physics, or later on like biology or history or a strange language like, you know, like Latin, for example, or whatever. Like, you know, so that's the kind of like thing that I envision happening. And I'm pretty confident that no matter, like, you know, what we do is going to happen anyway, sooner or later. And I'd prefer it happen sooner. Yeah.
Yeah, so following on from that, so you mentioned sort of, obviously the mission for the game, or the mission for the game is learning, but, you know, in order to get there, it needs to stand up next to those other pure games in that way. Obviously part of that is this kind of cult of those characters and how much kids get so into and fall in love with all these characters. So down the road, you know, is it likely that some of these Big Bang characters will have merchandising and go down that whole route to, you know, in the same way?
Yeah, definitely. So it's actually the part of it's kind of part of our playbook from day one has been to create this like larger ecosystem around the game. So Lightnear is and will be a gaming studio. So we don't want to grow into this like multimedia house or anything, but we want to find amazing partners that we can team up with to create stuff like books and toys and an animated TV show and stuff like that. And we're already doing some work in those fields. Like, for example, we're developing an animated show. We are modeling, like creating 3D models of the characters that can be used as basis for toys and stuff like that, to sort of like to accelerate working with those partners. And the idea is also that because one of the sort of like big challenges for learning games is that if a learning game gets teachy, people are going to turn it down. That's one of the findings.
If it gets teachy. Yeah.
So one of the things that I've been telling people, that especially teachers have some like, you know, trouble, you know, sort of approaching, is that the game actually doesn't teach you anything at all. So that's been kind of a design cornerstone. It doesn't have pop-ups to tell you that, did you know that atoms have protons inside them? But it's rather like, you know, that you just play the game and you bump your accelerator atoms into walls, and then you find quarks and you collect them, and then when you have enough quarks you create protons. It's all like in the like I said earlier, like, you know, that like back in CERN when they were describing how particle physics works, they were actually describing a game. So that's how we've built the game. That means also that we've had to be very selective about what we can actually include as learning goals. So a couple of terms that we really try to avoid. So we don't want to teach anything. We actually even don't think about ourselves as educational. Mm-hmm. We think about ourselves as a learning game company. And I think the difference is that in education, I decide what you must learn. In learning, you decide what you want to learn. And this is what we want to facilitate, is giving this, like, at the end of the day, this palettes of, like, you know, opportunities to learn.
Yeah, so what are your goals in terms of downloads and that kind of thing?
So the downloads, We aim to have $100 million by the end of 2018. So that's the thinking. We already have a pretty solid roadmap to get to 10. And, like, of course, it all presumes that we, you know, get a great game out of the door.
Yep.
In November, and it's going to be an exciting time for us to see when the game comes out and how people are going to...
Have you got lots of people doing all-nighters at the moment, or...?
No.
Not yet.
Actually, that's been a really, like, sort of deeply question we've had with the team, and I think, like, you know, in order to create the really long-term culture that attracts the best of the talent out there. So one thing that I really want to do is to create a culture that's nurturing for the people. And I don't think, like, working all-nighters and, like, you know, really burning out people is nurturing for people. And that loops back to what I said, that it's really, like, you know, if you're in Helsinki, come visit us at the office. You can feel the sort of, like, this, like, love and excitement that's going on with these guys there. So it's, like, you know, of course, like, you know, as we approach the launch, there might be a little, like, bit we need to push at some point, but I don't want to get into this sort of, like, you know, because these guys are basically every single person in the office is a genius. That's like, you know, it's really great. Like, I feel like this little dwarf surrounded by giants whenever I come there.
Do you have, like, an office pet? We had an office dog
actually for a couple of days now, but just for a while. But we have office kids.
Okay.
Like, my kids are constantly, like, you know, pestering me, like, you know, then, Dad, when can I come back to your working place? Yeah, and I'm like, you know, the other day I just took my 2 and 4 year olds, and then when the 7 and 10 year olds found out that these, because they're in school,
and they
right?
were really annoyed.
They were really like, you know, why didn't we get to come? So now we made the scheme with my wife that, like, the next time, for next week when I'm bringing them on again, I'm gonna take the younger ones, like, in the daytime, and straight after school the older ones get to take the bus and come straight to the office so they can, like, you know, play with the games and toys and everything. But it's like, you know, it's just, it's an amazing bunch of people, and it's an amazing place to work with them.
I remember now what we were talking about before. It was about the sort of merchandising and then also collaborating with partners. So I can sort of see, you know, would you be collaborating with educational publishers or, you know, other people? Like, you obviously mentioned CERN, but are there other partners in the pipeline?
There are lots of amazing talks that's something I unfortunately can't disclose publicly quite yet, but there are going to be, I suppose there are going to be some big news in the pipeline hopefully quite soon already. We have had some, like, really amazing talks with, like, some, like, world-class potential partners, and so yeah, my thought cut up earlier a little, but now I remember also what I was aiming at with all that, like, why the game can't be teaching. So one of the reasons why we wanted to start already, like, you know, even though we don't have a kind of a broadcast partner for it yet, that we already wanted to start developing the animation, is that because the game as a platform sets certain limits to how much we can actually, you know, how much learning goals and content we can put into that, we want to use other media like books, comics, and the animation to sort of to deepen that knowledge. So the game gives you some idea of, like, you know, like this causal chain from Big Bang to a helium balloon, of this, like, basic hierarchies of particle physics, but with a kind of a dramatic narrative, you can actually deepen that knowledge a lot. And that actually loops back to why I just wrote this blog post a couple of weeks ago entitled Why Lightyear Exists. And the one thing we don't want to do, we don't want to make a business out of, like, education. We don't want to compete with schools. We don't want to sell this, like, product. We don't want to sort of, like, put this in a kind of an opposition of traditional ways of learning. Mm-hmm. Rather, what we think is that right now there are certain thresholds in especially complex topics like physics that prevent people that might, like, you know, find that same light in their eyes as this CERN, like, PhD professor level, like, super physicists, if they only had the chance to, like, you know, get started. But now we start, like, you know, when kids come to school and you pull out the periodic table and everybody, like, a big bunch of these kids feels intimidated by that. So we don't want to teach you what the physics teacher teaches you. That's, you know, because I think still, even though I'm, you know, we're in the learning game business, I still think that the best way to learn anything is to learn with a teacher who loves the topic that she teaches. So no game is ever going to be able to compete with that, and I don't think any game should. But what games can do is we can introduce in that 2-hour chunk where the kids are playing, like, you know, my kids are completely bonkers about Pokemon Go, for example. So in that space, if we make a game that's sticky enough, that's fun enough, that the kids just like, you know, gravitate towards naturally, and they start playing that, and they start encountering things like helium and beryllium and da-da-da, and it becomes something that's not intimidating but familiar. And then they go to the physics class, and the teacher pulls down the periodic table.
They start saying helium.
Exactly. So instead of this intimidating, like, you know, barrage of like strange letters and Latin names, there are the guys, they're friends, like they have the toys in their bedrooms and they've watched the animated series and they've kind of like, you know, they've played the game and they know them and they recognize them. They go like, and the teacher goes like, you know, like who knows how many protons go into a carbon atom, and everybody like, you know, puts their hands up and they go like, well, obviously it's six because everybody knows that because they've played.
Why wouldn't you know that? And then, I mean, the other thing is so my understanding is that there are a really great proportion of game players that are maybe women, sort of in their, is it about their 40s, and then obviously we've got a deficit of female scientists, so you know, do you think it can go some way to reaching out to help solve that problem as well?
I'd love that. So, I'd really, you know, I'd love that. One thing that really, like, personally, like, what is a big driver for me is this whole idea of, like I said earlier, why Finnish education? I mean, there are many reasons. We have amazing teachers. We have, you know, pretty amazing, like, our new curriculum is like a work of art. You should look it up. It's just mind-blowingly amazing. I'm sorry, I'm just waxing too hyper.
No, but I know that a lot of people look to Finland all the time to, you know, for inspiration in new ideas, new approaches for education. Obviously, notice that you're continually at the top of those tables for a reason. So I think it makes sense to be that way, probably.
Yeah, yeah, and but the, like all these things being said, I think the key cornerstone in Finnish education is inclusivity. It's the fact that everybody gets to learn. Everybody gets to go to a great school. And that's something that's, you know, that's, you don't, I mean, it's unfair that it only happens in this crazy, like, small 5 million person Scandinavian country. And it should happen everywhere. And that's the kind of, like, driver, like, how to make inclusivity scale. That's the kind of, like, that's, I think, for myself personally, that's the biggest driver for why I think Lightner is so important. And why the work that we are doing with these amazing people can actually have a huge impact, and the thinking is that we are not, because you know we're not a very typical gaming company. We have this like I said, also like it's so great to work with investors who actually share our mission. So we are not targeting only markets that are lucrative. We're actually from the get-go, we're also going to be targeting markets that don't make us any, even if we decide to, you know, go with the monetizing version of the game, we're targeting markets that are probably not going to make a single dime to us. And we're actually spending a considerable amount of our marketing budget to reach people in those, for example, developing countries. And, you know, when he said, like, you know, that we have a deficit of female scientists, we also have a deficit of sub-Saharan scientists. Mm-hmm. And putting a game in the hands of those kids there that have no education, no access to education, but where many companies, many people are right now pushing the technological infrastructure. So in a couple of years, I mean, already pretty much everybody has a cell phone. In a couple of years, everybody's going to have a cell phone powerful enough to run a game. And now if you have somebody, some 11-year-old, you know, teenage, like not even teenage, like girl living in a small village in, like, you know, Tanzania, and they have their, like, you know, they have a game that they can play, maybe share with friends, like, you know, on a single cell phone in the village, and they start understanding how the particle physics hierarchy goes, and then basically, like, you know, get this sort of like spark that you go online and you start watching MOOCs and learning. I mean, there's like on Coursera, there are Harvard level, like, you know, lessons on these things. So these people who don't have the education infrastructure that, you know, us who've been, like, you know, lucky have, they start getting the chance to access this whole treasure trove of knowledge that's online. And at the end of the day, I think one thing that I really want to, and actually that I just put on our roadmap a couple of months ago, is that right now we're going to be focusing on physics, chemistry, and natural sciences for at least for the next 2 years. But around 2018, if everything goes well, I'd really love for us to start working on a literacy game.
This is going to be one of my questions,
And preferably, I just, like, you know, a game that combines literacy with basically English as a foreign language, because I just realized about half a year ago, and if you have a game that is much fun to play as Angry Birds, that's about that teaches you to read and teaches you a kind of rudimentary command of English. What that game is, when you push it to developing countries where people have no access to high quality education because of these language barriers, but who have, I mean, a gazillion times more motivation to learn than any of even us who are like enthusiastic. But these people, I mean, having, if we gave them access to these MOOCs and this treasure trove of knowledge, they would just soar. And what a hugely fun and engaging game teaching you literacy and English is, it's the skeleton key to the internet. It's the way to open up this whole treasure trove of knowledge to everybody in the world. And I think that's the sort of the big vision behind everything we're doing, that at the end of the day, we're going to be able to push. I mean, the technology infrastructure is getting there already, but the tech itself does nothing before there's some content that's life-changing. And I think putting that game in that tech all over the world, especially in these developing countries, is going to have a huge impact on the way we learn in the world.
Okay, just to wrap up then, top three games, your top three games.
Right now, Ratchet and Clank, beyond a doubt. I love that game. It's like, you know, we played with my kids, so we have like, it's one of the, like, you know, the big moments in my life right now, that whenever I come home from work, my kids rush to the door, and they go, my 2-year-old hops up, and they're going, Ratchet Clank, Ratchet Clank. And then we put the PlayStation and played for like, you know, 15 minutes or something. I have the kids all, like, you know, I have 5 kids, so the one is the baby, so he doesn't care about.
Yeah, that's quite astonishing. 5 kids. Well done.
But the 4 of them are like,
your,
you know,
that's your
like
future workforce, all set.
Yeah,
up.
Yeah. They're my little beta testers. So.
Yeah, yeah.
So Ratchet and Clank is, and the other one that I've been super stoked about is No Man's Sky. So No Man's Sky is just another PlayStation game where you just explore the universe. And my kids, we started playing that with kids as well, but they kind of grew bored. But I really love this sense of being in an alternative universe. And I think right now, for mobile games, right now, if I had to choose one, it's actually surprisingly also a learning game. It's a game called Human Resource Machine. Okay. And that's actually, by the way, that's in addition to Dragon Box, it's another one. If you want to learn the kind of groundwork of how coding works, Human Resource Machine is way beyond anything I've seen there.
Okay.
It's such a fun, geeky game to play. And when you play it further and further, you learn to do things like using input-output strings to sort prime numbers. And it's like, you know, it gets like, you know, it gets like super math geeky, like, you know.
Well, I know you have a Global Teacher Award nominee focused on maths, I believe, in Finland from the last round. So,
right, Marit Rossi, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, she's amazing. She's a really, really fantastic human being.
And then what about top philosophers for people to take away, to inspire them?
Well, by far my number one philosopher is C.I. Lewis. So he was a Harvard professor in the 40s. I made my PhD on his thinking. So he wrote a 10-page paper that saved me 10 years of active research. I'll never forget that. He cracked this, like, something that I'd been thinking for 20 years or something, and I read a 10-page paper and it solved it. So C.I. Lewis is big for me. I love Plato. I mean, Plato, I think especially in Finland, it's a shame that philosophy has become this like super academic, like, you know, that you're just like looking at single like expressions and trying to figure them out. Because I think what I loved about philosophy was, you know, entertaining larger than life ideas and trying to figure them out. And Plato was definitely like one of the big ones there. And maybe, like, you know, if I had to choose 3, I'd choose 4, because there's a kind of an interesting amalgamation of Søren Kierkegaard and Ludwig Wittgenstein. So there's a kind of they're pretty different philosophers. So Wittgenstein was more into logic and stuff like that, and Kierkegaard was, like, you know, sort of proto-existentialist. But the two of them together, there's a really interesting resonance there about this idea that sort of at the end of the day, even no matter how, it actually loops back to this very Socratic idea that even the wisest of us don't really know that much about anything. And I did my master's thesis on this one sentence in Wittgenstein's Tractatus Logica Philosophicus, which basically says that, like, you know, my words are like ladders, and after you've used the words to, you know, basically to, I'm not, you know, quoting verbatim, obviously, I'm just like kind of paraphrasing, but after you use my words to reach understanding, you can throw the ladder away. So everything that we're talking, everything that we're like putting to words is actually one step short of understanding. The understanding always sort of supersedes words and language, and understanding happens when we actually, like, you know, take this like sort of leap beyond language.
It's kind of that sediment of experience. So once everything's kind of bedded down in terms yes. of actually what you've learned through it, you can't live only by sort of these wonderful quotes alone. You have to go out and
exactly.
experience it yourself.
Exactly.
Well, on that note, thank you so, so much, and good luck with everything up to November. And no doubt many, many teachers will meet you all at BET in January.
Yeah, I'd love that. Thank you, Sophie. It was really great talking with you.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that epic ramble chat. More stories coming up from Australia with Education Changemakers and the UK with UCL Knowledge Lab and Dr. Rose Lukin. Have a great week.